broken or just an item of clothing that has one too many holes, join the Repair Cafe event held by SPEC in partnership with the City of Vancouver down at the West End Community Center on Saturday, June 22nd, between 9:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Get involved and do your part in reducing waste. And if you bring your own mug, there's free coffee and tea. Head over to spec.bc.ca/events for more information.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Today on Wings, an Irish senator and a former New Zealand prime minister discuss women politicians' leadership on issues affecting women and kids. Their conversation was hosted by the International Parliamentary Union.
There's so much to fight for. There's so much that we need the women's voices in our parliaments for, that we need the male allies in our parliaments for, because if we don't get in the trenches and defend gains that we've made and promote gains that we've yet to make, we stand to really regress.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
IPU On Air, the Interparliamentary Union's podcast.
My name is Lorraine Clifford Lee, and I'm a senator from Ireland, and I am the chair of the IPU Health Advisory Group. I am honoured to have a very special guest with me here today, the Right Honourable Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and the chair of the board of the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health. Helen Clark served a remarkable three terms as Prime Minister of New Zealand from 1999 to 2008. Cabinet positions she held prior to becoming Prime Minister include the Health Ministry. She served a total of 27 years as a Member of Parliament. After leaving Parliament, Helen Clark became the first female head of the United Nations Development Programme and served in this position for 8 years. In this episode, we will discuss how the right to health, women's rights and women's empowerment is inextricably linked.
We've got a lot coming at our societies. We've been through the height of the pandemic, and COVID, of course, has never gone away, and many are left with the legacy of long COVID. We have extreme climate events impacting health and well-being. And then we have this just ghastly number of horrible conflicts taking lives and hopes and destroying communities day in, day out. Now, it's always the most vulnerable who are impacted the most. And at the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health, where we advocate for women, children and adolescents, we say that those groups are particularly impacted by everything that's happening. We know that we have forced rapid displacement from disasters. It's women who are more likely to lose their lives. And then with conflicts, you have the gender-based violence always associated with conflicts. Now, add to that the rise of populist and authoritarian leaders, never good for women's rights. And the specific rollback on rights that we've seen in some countries. Of course, the picture's mixed. We had significant forward movement on sexual and reproductive health and rights under the previous Argentine government. Who knows what will happen now in Mexico and in Colombia. But when the United States of America does away with a constitutional right to abortion, this is of huge significance, and it encourages anti-rights people around the world. We see a lot of very adverse trends. For example, pushback against law where it was in place against female genital mutilation. We're seeing pushback in Somalia on an age of maturity, which is lower than the age of adulthood and implies early marriage could be possible. There's so much to fight for. There's so much that we need the women's voices in our parliaments for, that we need the male allies in our parliaments for, because if we don't get in the trenches and defend gains that we've made and promote gains that we've yet to make, we stand to really regress. Already we've seen the reduction in maternal mortality plateau with the impact on services of the pandemic. We stopped making progress. Now, hopefully, we can claw back again.
It's important to remember that gender inequalities, and especially violence against women and harmful practices, have significant health impacts through unintended pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy and birth complications, and of course, mental health impacts throughout a woman's life. And although this is well known, the discussion around gender equality and women's rights are often polarised and guided by entrenched social norms and beliefs. But we can't forget that we're talking about the health and well-being of millions of people globally. So, Helen, I was wondering, why is it that health is not the starting point? And how can we centre the debate back on the health impacts?
Health is so critical to gender equality. Take, for a start, sexual and reproductive health and rights. If we don't have bodily autonomy because of repressive law or misogyny or a domineering male in the home, we can never develop to our full potential. If the norm in the society is that it's fine to marry off a girl, often as a second wife in these circumstances, when she reaches the age of menstruation, this girl may never complete her education. Look, you know, in my own country, in your country, we know the phenomenon of teenage pregnancy, but we find ways of getting girls back to school and having the baby supported and getting a second chance. Unfortunately, for many in the situations where an early marriage is the norm and early childbearing is the norm, there's no second chance. That then impacts right through a woman's life. It also impacts intergenerationally because the research shows that a woman who's been educated and having her children later, her children will be healthier. And then she will have more aspirations for them. So it will have benefits for future generations as well. So if we centre basic rights, rights to bodily autonomy, right to determine your fertility, right to make your own choices about if you marry, who you marry, if you have children, how many, these critical issues are centred back in the health system where we really need access and services.
Absolutely. And, you know, when marriage happens very early, the power dynamic is set up from the very start. The economic imbalance is there. And that then leads to a very vulnerable situation for women and are more susceptible to domestic violence and the obvious health impacts that that has on that particular woman and her children. And as you said, then the negative consequences can go down the generations, but positive consequences can go down generations as well. I think parliamentary action is really important when it comes to women's health. In Ireland, we have set a plan to eliminate cervical cancer by 2040 through vaccination, screening and treatment. However, changes in laws are not enough if changes in beliefs and attitudes are not taking place as well. So the parliamentary action around this goal is encouraging women to take time for their own health, take time to go for the screening, because quite often women from all different types of backgrounds put their own health last, because they're doing the caring, unpaid, paid caring, working outside the home, working inside the home, and putting everybody else's. Prioritising your own health as a woman, you're prioritising your family's well-being. So it's very important that parliaments actually take an active role in encouraging good health practices for women and girls in particular, and bringing those voices to the fore.
Well, this is a very important role for parliaments to play. Many parliamentary committees have an investigatory function where they can call for people to come forward. Myself, you know, being a younger member of parliamentary committees, I've seen a young woman in New Zealand who was very badly abused by police officers, and whose preparedness to come out and speak openly led to a full inquiry into police culture and quite a lot of changes. So providing the platforms for the lived experience just has such an impact. The first piece of legislation that I sat on a committee for in New Zealand way back in 1982 was the Domestic Violence Act. And needless to say, we heard a lot of lived experience, and that informed what we did. I can just think of so many examples where parliaments have played a positive role in hearing that evidence and feeding it back into strengthened legislation to uphold women's rights.
Yeah, and that's my own experience as well. And sometimes I often feel when we have members of the public or people who are giving their lived experience into committees and they're bearing their souls and talking about deeply personal lived experiences, I often feel, you know, is this what we need to prompt us into action as parliamentarians? Do ordinary private citizens have to bare their souls to us? But on the other hand, it is so powerful, and that's really what prompts action. And we recently had changes to our constitution and abortion laws, and it was through the lived experience and the advocacy of civil society that brought around that change and forced us into action, really, after years and years of avoiding and sidestepping the issue. So it's really important. And the coordination and cooperation of civil society with parliaments is very, very important.
Well, I can think of an example in New Zealand back in the late 70s where we had a law on abortion which actually wasn't an obstacle to getting an abortion, because it was possible to save the mental and physical health of the mother. And then there was a movement in the parliament which was overwhelmingly dominated by men, right? Four women members of parliament out of, you know, 80 plus. And these men drove through an amendment to the law that basically outlawed abortion. And what civil society did was then organise flights of women to Sydney, where abortion was quite legal. And the sight of this, week in, week out, the planes going from New Zealand to Sydney with women saying, you know, I have to have access to an abortion. You know, they changed the law. I mean, that's one of the most powerful examples I've seen of where civil society said, we're not going to put up with this. We're not going to see New Zealand women denied this right. And the law got changed. So, yeah, you know, let's never think we're powerless. You know, collective action, parliamentary advocacy, people prepared to be champions. This does make a difference for women, and that's why women's voices in Parliament are so important, because in the end we have to lead on these things. We will have male allies, but they're often not the ones to step forward and really, you know, pick up the cause, but they will come with us if we show the leadership.
Absolutely. I think we have to be brave as parliamentarians, and you have to be true to yourself. And when I was elected to Parliament, abortion was a real live issue. It had been part of the election campaign, and people told me that I should, you know, not talk about it. It's going to destroy your political career. It's a divisive issue. Just steer away from it. It's not ever going to change. It's none of your business. And just, you know, think about yourself. And I said, well, I'm not here to just sit back and do nothing. And we need to be brave. And if that costs me votes or my political career, so be it. But I'm here to make change, and bravery was required. And we had a critical mass of women that were empowered to be brave. And together then we convinced other people to be brave with us. And we, along with civil society, changed it. But I think it is very important to lead from the front on these issues, and our male allies will come with us. But it does require a big leap of faith sometimes, especially if you're new in Parliament. And as a parliamentarian, I'm very much aware of the sexist attitudes and threatening language and behaviours, sexualised abuse and gender-based discrimination and intimidation that women parliamentarians are subjected to quite often. And politics has always been a tough game, but it's way tougher for women. There's no denying that. Men have historically dominated politics, and this attitude of discrediting and undermining women parliamentarians and politicians continues both inside and outside of Parliament.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from a new podcast series by the International Parliamentary Union. IPU is an organization currently comprising 180 of the 190 national parliaments that are currently functioning in the world. One of their activities is ranking countries by the percentage of women in their legislative bodies. As of April 24, 2024, Rwanda still held the top spot, followed by Cuba, Nicaragua, and Mexico. Australia was in 32nd place, Canada 65th. The U.S. was tied with Iraq for 72nd place. These percentages have a lot to do with the country's electoral systems, as Helen New Zealand and Irish Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee explain. New Zealand was ranked in 16th place for percentage of women in Parliament, and Ireland 103rd. But even at just 37%, Irish women have influence in Parliament.
A landmark IPU survey of women parliamentarians worldwide has shown that 80% had been subjected to psychological violence and 20% had been sexually harassed. And I think that's incredible. What would your response to that be, Helen? Is it getting worse or better? And are parliaments perpetrating gender biases, or are they providing solutions to significant barriers to women parliamentarians doing their jobs? A lot of questions in one.
Yeah. I think that the misogynist elements in our societies who really don't like seeing women in any position of authority, they've always been there. They were there in my time, but they didn't have social media to parade their hate and on and build their communities on. And that's the big difference. And so there's been really incredible targeting of women parliamentarians through these social media platforms, the trolling, the hate, the abuse, the smears, the lies, the harassment, you know, and it tips over into, you know, the physical threats. And this has an impact on women politicians. I mean, we have the very well-known resignation of Jacinda Ardern after 5 years as New Zealand Prime Minister. She said she had no more gas in the tank. And one of the reasons for having no more gas in the tank was just the relentless misogynist abuse and attack that she came under. The Dutch Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, Sigrid Kaag, resigned last year. And she said she just couldn't go on. She'd had enough. And believe me, she's a strong woman. She used to work for me, as Jacinda did. They're not sort of weak, you know, shrinking violets, but it became too much. And I think this is quite shocking. So parliaments need to set a tone themselves that they're going to stand by each other. But of course, often we're finding in our parliaments that there's been a lot of abuse and harassment of male members against female members and so on. And some of the behaviour, even in the debating chamber, is scarcely printable. So parliaments have a lot to learn about how to treat people well. And if we don't unite across parties in parliament around these issues, then we're not giving good signals out to the broader public about what the expectations of a fair and just society actually are.
And I think to add into the mix, the former Prime Minister of Finland as well, Sanna Marin, and I'm always struck by the press conference she did with Jacinda Ardern and was asked a question, you know, are you discussing things because you're women and the same age? And Sanna Marin said, no, we're prime ministers. That's what we're discussing. That's why we're meeting together. Like, it was really incredible. And she was another one that stepped back from frontline politics because of the particular gendered abuse that she was getting. And I sometimes wonder that, you know, we've had female prime ministers like yourself and a number of others globally, and you've cracked the glass ceiling. But has the experience of women actually been a deterrent for other women entering politics, or women who have entered politics and deciding to step back at a lower level and not seek ministerial office or not seek leadership positions in parties?
Well, this is the worry now, that that women might take the signal that it's just too rough and too nasty and too horrible. As I say, it's always had its downside, believe me, having weathered quite a lot of that. So I think the message I'd like people to take from what's happened is, how can we build resilience? And people should never feel, women should never feel that they have to do all this on their own, right? We need teams. We need support. We need to say we need some help. We need to back each other. Because if we let people stand alone and just feel this incredible pressure, it's too much. So building resilience is about building the teams around you, which will be colleagues, it'll be friends, it'll be family, that keep you going even in the bleakest moments. So that's the message I'd take. But I do worry that young women will say, oh, God, this is so awful, I just couldn't do it. If we don't do it, we leave it, you know, to the same old gender men making decisions for us, and that's not acceptable.
Yeah, I'm often invited into schools to talk to students about my career in politics, and I get a lot of all-girls schools that invite me in, and a lot of women interested in my own personal story and the work I'm doing. And I'm always conflicted about talking about the difficult side of it, because it, you know, while it's important, it does put people off. And I'm always trying to get that across to people, saying, yes, this is an element, but it's not the main thing that dominates my daily work or the work of any of the women that I work with. And in Ireland, we introduced gender quotas for elections back in 2012. And now we're actually at a point that political parties have to field 40% of female candidates for election to avail of state funding of political parties, which is a significant amount of funding. So political parties are highly motivated now to go out and find female candidates and female members within the ranks and promote them and encourage them to stand for election. And I know this is something you've spoken about in the past, Helen, about women being allowed the opportunity to contest winnable seats. It's all well and good standing for election, but unless you can actually be elected and progress up through the party in leadership positions, I think we're going to have difficulty attracting highly ambitious and motivated women into politics and to lead that change.
Yes, the electoral system has quite an impact on the proportion of women elected. New Zealand went to a German-style mixed-member proportional system, different from the single transferable vote, which I think Ireland has. And with the system we have, you have nationwide lists which elect half the parliament and the other half from constituencies. But particularly on the list, that put a lot of pressure on political parties to up the numbers of women in winnable places. And under Jacinda's government, we actually got to a parliament that was gender equal, men and women. It has slipped back a bit, I think, but you know, we're always going to be around that now or close to it. But where countries stick to the old, you know, Westminster style, US style parliaments, you know, the person who gets the most vote wins, that's not the best system for women to come through on at all. So I often say, when people are saying, why can't we get more women? I say, look at your electoral system. It may have barriers. Many years ago, when I was at the UN Development Programme, our gender team did a report on overcoming barriers to women's parliamentary representation. And they identified three things in particular. One, political parties have to be prepared to lead on this. They can be our greatest champions or our greatest opponents, but we need them to be champions and ensure that women are put in winnable places, not just put up and say, oh, well, X percent of our candidates are women, but no, how many are in winnable places? That's critical. Secondly, it's about money. You know, everyone needs to raise money for a campaign. And traditionally, the old boys' networks have been more lucrative than the old girls' networks. So finding ways to equalise the funding, parties have to be familiar with that. And then these days, security is an issue. Security for women who are campaigning. I mean, heaven knows, we saw, you know, a woman MP killed in the United Kingdom, Jo Cox. We saw Benazir Bhutto assassinated as she stood campaigning through the roof of her car. Security is a real issue in high-income, medium-income, low-income countries. And our political parties have to be conscious of that and, you know, make sure that women aren't sent out like lambs to the slaughter, where misogynists can cause them significant security difficulties.
Absolutely. And I think in this year of elections, that's ever more pertinent as well. And hopefully We won't see any more deaths of parliamentarians globally. Helen, during your time as Prime Minister, you displayed incredible leadership to improve the lives of women and children in New Zealand. I'm thinking in particular of the Private Member's Bill in relation to smacking children, which your government supported. This faced a lot of vocal opposition, yet your leadership saw it become law and change the culture in New Zealand. Can you talk about what women's leadership in politics means to you and how it can make a difference for women's and girls' health and well-being?
When you're elected as a Member of Parliament, you are conscious that you're there to represent the constituency, and when you become Prime Minister, you're representing the country. So you represent across gender, but you also feel a special responsibility to even up the odds for women. And I think, you know, back over my career, there's been a lot of opportunities I've had to make a real difference in that respect for women and children. You mentioned, for example, the Child Discipline Act. That was a very difficult issue because people just somehow assume they have a right to hit their kids. Well, actually, that's an assault. Why should an assault against a child be treated differently from an assault on the street? If someone whacks me on the street with a bit of wood or a riding crop or, you know, badly hurts me, that's an assault. Why should you be able to do that to your children? We had a waiver in the Crimes Act in New Zealand which said that physical discipline of children was permitted for purposes of parental correction. And, of course, with smart lawyers over the decades, this law became so interpreted with case law that people were getting off charges brought by the police, even though they had severely assaulted children. So, yes, there was a private member's bill from a Green Party member. It got into a lot of trouble with, you know, fundamentalist public opinion. And in the end, I said the government would support the bill. We threw our weight behind it. I ended up reaching across the aisle to our key opponents, the New Zealand Conservative Party, National Party. And to be fair to them, they came across and supported it. So we were able to confine the opposition in Parliament to it, to a very, very small number of MPs and a small party. But it was a tough, tough issue. And it was a tough one for me to front on because I don't have children myself. So that opened me up to this ridiculous criticism of, she's never had children, so how would she know? Well, what I know is it's wrong to physically abuse a child, and that has mental health consequences as well. So, you know, changing the law doesn't lead to instant changes of behaviour, but over time it will change attitudes and norms that it's not right to beat your children. So, yeah, it requires a bit of courage to step up on those things, but I've no doubt that the right thing was done.
Wings thanks the Interparliamentary Union for use of content from their podcast under their Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. Their website is ipu.org. This episode of IPU On Air featured a dialogue between host Irish Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee, chair of the IPU Advisory Group on Health, and Right Honourable Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand and chair of the board of the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health. Wings appreciates all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIST.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.